Hey, are you looking for a true crime podcast to binge?
Check out True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everyone's talking about.
We've been one of the top true crime podcasts for almost 9 years.
And we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Into the Killing. If you have a case you want us to cover on Into the Killing, please go to our website, criminallylisted.com. We love to hear about cold cases that were eventually solved, but they aren't well known. We'd also love to hear from you if you have cases to suggest for our YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. And now, for today's case. We're going back to the beginning of 1974. On January 2, 1974, President Richard Nixon signed a law making the national speed limit in all states 55 miles per hour, or 89 kilometers per hour. The law was in response to the 1973 oil crisis. The hope was that people would drive slower, thus save on gas. The law also ended up contributing to many lives being saved. Fatality rates dropped from 4.28 per million miles traveled in 1972 to 2.73 in 1983. Days after changing the speed limit, on January 4th, Nixon refused to hand over tapes subpoenaed by the Watergate Committee. On January 13th, Super Bowl VIII was held at Rice Stadium in Houston, Texas. The Miami Dolphins defeated the Minnesota Vikings 24-7. It was Miami's second consecutive Super Bowl win. On January 15th, 1974, the number one song was the soul classic, Show and Tell by Al Wilson. It was Wilson's only number one hit song. The number one movie at the box office was the horror classic, The Exorcist. The supernatural horror film, directed by William Friedkin, eventually spent 12 weeks in the top spot. The Exorcist became the first horror movie to be nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. It received 9 other nominations. It won 2 awards, Best Sound and Best Adapted Screenplay. In early 1974, 21-year-old Taylor Eugene Courtney lived alone in an apartment in Phoenix, Arizona. Courtney worked as a welder. By all accounts, he was a nice young man who avoided trouble. He didn't do drugs, he didn't drink, and he didn't go to bars. Courtney grew up in Ajo, Arizona, which is about 110 miles southwest of Phoenix. He often drove home on the weekends to see his family. His family became worried when he didn't come home on the second weekend of January and he didn't call. So his family contacted the police. But the police didn't take the call too seriously. After all, a 21-year-old man blowing off his parents for a weekend wasn't exactly a reason to panic. Then, on January 15, 1974, the police in Phoenix were called because a pickup truck had been abandoned on a street. The truck was on blocks and the tires were missing. The passenger door was open. Inside the cab of the truck was a considerable amount of blood. The police learned that the truck was registered to 21-year-old Taylor Courtney, who lived about 3 miles from where the truck was found. The police went to his apartment, and when no one answered the door, they entered it. Courtney's apartment was bathed in blood. It was like something out of a horror movie. The officers found the dead body of Taylor Courtney face down on his bedroom floor. The homicide detectives turned over the body to inspect it. If the crime scene wasn't shocking enough, the detectives retreated to another shock. Taylor's penis, scrotum, and testicles had been cut off. The officers searched the apartment and they couldn't find them. It appeared that the killer took the genitals with him. The medical examiner determined that Taylor had been dead for 6 days. He had been shot in the head 3 times and stabbed 6 times. Then his genitals were removed post-mortem. Based on the amount of blood in the truck, the police surmised that he was shot and stabbed in his truck and then dragged into his apartment where he was mutilated. The police technicians found several fingerprints, including some in blood. The problem was that there was no computerized fingerprint system at the time, so fingerprint comparisons had to be done manually. This was only helpful if the police had a suspect and they could compare the fingerprints. Unfortunately, in Courtney's case, they had no suspects. Courtney stayed away from trouble, and no one the police interviewed knew why someone would want to kill him, especially in such a grisly fashion. Without any leads, Taylor Courtney's case went cold. 21 years went by, and then in 1995, a cold case detective decided to look at Taylor Courtney's file. A lot had changed in those 21 years. In 1995, U.S. Congress gave the states the right to set their own speed limits, effectively ending the national speed limit. Super Bowl 29 was held in Miami, Florida. The San Francisco 49ers defeated the San Diego Chargers 49-26. The biggest songs in 1974 were The Way We Were by Barbra Streisand, Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks, and Love's Theme by the Love Unlimited Orchestra. The Love Unlimited Orchestra was a 40-piece string-laden orchestra formed by R&B legend Barry White. In 1995, the top song was Gangsta's Paradise by Coolio featuring LV. Songs 2 and 3 were both by girl group TLC. They were Waterfalls and Creep. The Towering Inferno, starring Paul Newman and Steve McQueen, was the top box office draw in 1974. The second and third biggest box office hits were both comedies directed by Mel Brooks and starred Gene Wilder, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. 1974's Best Picture at the Academy Awards was the caper classic The Sting, starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford. The biggest movies in 1995 were Die Hard with a Vengeance, Toy Story, and Apollo 13, while Braveheart took home the Academy Award for Best Picture. In those 21 years, a computerized fingerprint database was created, and the Phoenix Police Department was utilizing it. It's called the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, also known as AFIS. When cold case investigator Ed Reynolds reopened Taylor Courtney's case, one of the first things he did was send the 17 unidentified fingerprint lifts to the department's fingerprint expert. The expert found two prints that had enough points of interest to run an AFIS. On October 11, 1995, she ran the fingerprints and got a hit on one of the prints. It belonged to a man named Larry Gibson. Gibson had been a high school friend of Courtney's. Gibson had been arrested in 1977 for armed robbery at a convenience store, and that's why his fingerprints were in the system. He ended up serving 17 years in prison for the robbery. The print was from his left index finger and was found on the screen door of Courtney's apartment. This was problematic for Detective Reynolds because Gibson was a friend of Courtney's. His fingerprint could have gone on the door at any time when he was merely visiting Courtney. But it was Reynolds' best lead, so he decided to pursue it. He spent a year investigating Larry Gibson. During the investigation, Detective Reynolds thought, why would the killer cut off and take Courtney's genitals? One theory he came up with was that Courtney may have been having sexual relations with a woman who was in a relationship with another man. Or a jealous boyfriend or husband thought that Courtney was having sexual relations with their significant other. So he killed and sexually mutilated Courtney to make a statement. Since Gibson was Reynolds' only suspect, he tracked down the woman Gibson was married to at the time of the murder, Elena Bennett. When Courtney was killed, Gibson and Bennett were separated, but still legally married. On April 29, 1996, Reynolds interviewed Bennett. Here is a recording of the actual interview. The first voice you'll hear is Detective Reynolds.
Was he violent? Hyper-violent?
After I made the decision to divorce him, he became violent.
And how would he show his anger? What forms?
He would beat me.
Is this hard for you?
Yes.
Bennett told Reynolds that Gibson thought she was having an affair with Courtney, but she wasn't. Then she told Reynolds about a disturbing altercation she had with Gibson about 2 weeks after the murder.
I was laying there and he came in the bedroom and he asked me, "What are you doing?" And I opened my eyes. I was just on the verge of going to sleep. I opened my eyes and there was a double-barrel shotgun pointed at my head.
She said that Gibson pointed a double-barreled shotgun at her head.
Was he alone?
Yes.
What did he do?
He held it next to my head. He wanted to have sex, and I wouldn't. I was fighting with
him. She said she was fighting with Gibson.
And then he started trying to get him.
Then Gibson tied her up.
Did he have anything with him besides the shotgun?
He had a knife.
Gibson was armed with a knife. Once she was tied to the bed, he raped her. During the assault, Gibson asked her what she knew about Courtney's murder. Bennett denied knowing anything about it. When Gibson was done, and just before he was getting ready to leave the apartment, he handed Bennett a box. The detective asked Bennett what was in the box, but she wouldn't tell him. The interview ended a short time later. 2 months later, the detective and Bennett spoke on the phone. She was ready to talk about the package.
I remember what was in the package.
What was in the package?
It was the body pieces.
Okay. And that's pretty hard for you to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, let's be a little bit more specific. You said the body pieces. Just for the sake of it, what body pieces are you talking about?
It looked like a big thumb. A big finger.
But it wasn't a finger, was it?
No.
What was it?
It was the penis.
And were there testicles there also?
Yes.
Did you ever confront him with why he gave you a penis and testicles?
No, never, ever. Not ever.
Did he have any smart comment to make to you when he gave it to you?
He smiled and he said, "This is from my mom's house. Can I go ahead and keep it in your freezer?"
Bennett said that after that night, Gibson called her several times and asked her if she ever looked in the box. He then asked her what she did with it, and she said she had incinerated it. Detective Reynolds then decided it was time to talk to Larry Gibson. He interviewed him on June 21, 1996. One thing he wanted to do was see if there was a logical explanation as to why his fingerprint was on Courtney's screen door. Once again, the first voice you'll hear is Detective Reynolds.
Do you know where he lived at in Phoenix when he was killed?
No, except for what I read in the papers on Campbell.
Okay.
Campbell.
So you didn't associate very much with him at all?
Not after he moved to Phoenix.
Okay.
He then asked him about the story Elena Bennett told him that happened 2 weeks after the murder.
You held your wife hostage in her home at the barrel end of a shotgun. And you tied her to the bed and you raped her.
I did not.
Reynolds then went back to questioning him about the fingerprint evidence.
You've never been to Taylor's apartment?
I've never been to Taylor's apartment.
Never?
Never. Had never been there.
And how'd your fingerprints get in there?
I don't know.
They're in there.
I had never been there.
They're in there.
I had never been there.
It took me 22 years to get those fingerprints identified, and they're your fingerprints.
I've never been there.
Larry Gibson was subsequently charged with first-degree murder. He went to trial on December 3, 1998, 24 years after the murder. The trial lasted 7 days. The evidence against him was the single fingerprint and the fact that he told Detective Reynolds that he had never been to Courtney's home. The prosecution said that the only reason he had to lie was because he had killed Courtney. Elena Bennett also testified by getting the box with the genitals. The jury found Larry Gibson guilty of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. In April 2000, Gibson did a phone interview with AETV's Cold Case Files for prison. He denied ever giving Bennett the package she described, and he claimed he was innocent.
I'm not angry at my ex-wife. She said what she thought was right. I can't change what she said or her opinion of me. So I'm angry at you. Reynolds, I'm angry.
If you couldn't make out what he was saying, Gibson says, I'm not angry at my ex-wife. She said what she thought was right. I can't change what she said or her opinion of me. I'm angry at Reynolds. I'm angry with the system for putting me in prison for something I didn't do. But he still couldn't explain how his fingerprints were found on the screen door.
I wish I could. Like I said, there's a possibility that somebody could have lived there before.
Gibson said, I wish I could. Like I said, there's a possibility that someone could have lived there before Taylor Courtney, and I could have went over to see them. Larry Gibson died in prison in January 2009 at the age of 58. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Once again, if you have a case you want to suggest, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. But that's all for today. Thank you again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.
Are you looking for a true crime podcast to binge?
Check out True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everyone's talking about.
We've been one of the top true crime podcasts for almost 9 years.
And we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.